Hello, friends. We've been hanging out together for a whole day. Feels like a very full day, at least to us, the teaching team. So, how are you? Throw out a few words. How are you feeling right now? What's arising? How are you? Calm? Heavy. Tired. I think I heard two tireds. Somebody serious? Yes, serious. Okay, well, serious. Okay. What else? There was something here I didn't quite hear. Curious. Curious. Was that serious or curious? Curious. Serious, curious. Maybe they're the same. I hear tired. Me too. I'm tired. Long day. Intense also. The intensity. We're landing into the space together. Oh, it's a sweet fatigue, though. It's, for me at least, it's a sweet fatigue. Oh, yeah. This body. Yeah. This body is of the earth. Someday we'll be of the earth completely. So tonight, I'd like to offer some reflections and my hope, my intention with offering these reflections tonight. Is may they support us in deepening as we gradually go into the space. And a few things I'd like to discuss tonight. One is the role of intention in this practice. Some of the gifts of mindfulness of death. What are some potential gifts of this practice? Which relates to intention. Why do we want to do this anyway? And you might have come up with that today earlier when you were doing the contemplative inquiry with each other. I also want to talk about some typical reactions to our own mortality and also that there is another way. And here we are trying to contemplate. Trying to cultivate another way of being with this truth. Instead of being afraid of it, denying it, befriending it so that it doesn't scare us. We don't live in fear of it. And it has many benefits, I'll go into more detail. But also, so that actually we use its power. It's such a powerful thing that we're going to die. It's so powerful that our lives are impermanent. It can empower us to live more fully, more lovingly, more completely, more kindly. It's such a jet engine, and we're scared of it. Like, oh no! We hide this power away. We are scared of it. We hide this jewel. This is such an amazing jewel. It's a jewel we each have. We're gonna die, and it is a jewel. Instead of, oh, what a bummer. And in the talk tonight, in some ways, I want to talk about that it actually is the delusion of immortality or the sense of immortality is not so much a gift, but actually it's a burden. Really, if we had immortality, so many challenging outcomes that we haven't even considered, so. Some things for your consideration. So I want to begin with this quote, which I love from the Hindu epic Mahabharata legend, where the wise man Yudhisthira, the wise person Yudhisthira, is asked. What is the most amazing thing in all of life? And they say that a person seeing others die all around them never thinks they will die. Pretty amazing, it's so true. And yeah, we know we're gonna die. We know up here, right? We know up in our heads we're gonna die. Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. But we don't really know. We don't act out, we don't live out of that knowledge. And when we actually face that knowledge, when we bring that knowing that we're going to die, there's a sense of panic, anxiety, like, no, I don't want to face that I'm going to die. Like, no, instead of befriending it. So just really appreciate Yudhisthira's wisdom. So there are typical responses to death, and we know that from our society, and we know that from ourselves. And given that we're a little tired, actually, let's do a little bit of Socratic method. So what are some typical reactions to death in our society? Shout it out. Panic, fear. Thank you. Wait, I didn't hear it. Denial. Yes, denial of death. That's the title of a very famous book, which I'll talk about in a moment. What else? Wait. Shock. Am I going to die? Really? Wait. Thank you. What? Another one. Botox. Yes. Yes, Botox. It's another reaction. Thank you. Good one. What else? Control. Oh, yeah. Yeah, sense of control, trying to control. Yeah. Superstition. Yeah. Anger. The good one. Yes. Why? It's not supposed to happen this way. This is not fair. Whose fault is it that it's happening? Or, yeah. What else? Religion, not now. Yeah, not now. I'm too busy, right? Not now. It's not supposed to. Yeah. You guys are good. Indecision. Regret. Grief. Yeah. What's that? Not ready yet. Not ready ever. What else? You guys are good. Victimization. Yeah. So victimizing oneself, like, oh, I'm a victim, I'm not supposed, yeah, exactly. I'm the victim of, oh, poor me, I have to die. Yeah. Okay. Peace. Yeah, that's the alternative. We don't have a lot of that, but yes, we're getting there. Hold that thought. We're doing the typical reaction. That's not a typical reaction, but thank you. Hold that for everyone. What else? Any other typical reactions in society? Legacy, yeah. Othering. Yeah, yes. Love it. Othering is an important one. Actually, I'll mention that with respect to terror management theory and TMT. I'm going to talk about it in a moment. What else? Numbing. Yeah. Which goes kind of the sibling of denial. It's like, just denial is more active, or actually numbing is a way of denial, yeah. Blame, yeah. Blame. With anger and all that. Addiction, I heard addiction, yes. Great. Gotta save them, yeah, gotta fix it, gotta save them. This shouldn't be happening, yeah. Isolation, right? Yeah, I can see that also with you know, kind of isolating death, just kind of isolating it away. It's just like all, you know, the death, just like making it clean, isolating it, not, yeah. We don't want to bring it into our consciousness. It's too scary, too everything that you mentioned. Regret, yeah. I think that was mentioned in the second regret, yeah. More regret, exactly. Regret for others, regret for me. There's just kind of a delayed response to knowing that I'm going to die. Might as well, you know, act, live in accordance to it, whereas, you know, regret can arise, yeah. Guilt, yeah. You guys are good. Impulse buying, and then yes, oh my God, oh, this is so, you're setting me up for the rest of, for this next part of the talk. I love it. This is great. Impulse buying, yeah. So you took the words out of Ernest Becker's mouth. Ernest Becker is the author of The Denial of Death, this amazing book that got the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction in 1974. And started the whole field called terror management theory. And I see some of you are nodding. You know about terror management theory. Yes, you must be psychologist. Awesome, yeah. So this book, and since you talked about, I'll just have to read this quote. You set him up. You set Ernest Becker up. So here's a quote from him from The Denial of Death. And it's, gendered language, this is 1974, it's rather old, so I'll mention this and I'm going to read it, the quote as it is, but it is gendered. Modern man is drinking and drugging himself out of awareness, or he spends his time shopping, which is the same thing. As awareness calls for types of heroic dedication that his culture no longer provides for him. Society contrives to help him forget. Wow. Right? Did you get the various pieces of that? It requires, you know, this the awareness, it calls for a heroic dedication to cultivating an awareness. We're doing here, by the way, right? It's heroic that you guys are here. It really is that you're dedicating yourself to cultivating this kind of an awareness that our culture no longer provides. And in fact, our culture contrives to help us forget that we're going to die. Oh, yeah, bye. So many things to do and see and do, which is great. Not to say that there's a lot of value to life, but there is sort of a contriving. It's that isolation, it's that hiding away, pushing away. Here's another quote from Ernest Becker. Man literally drives himself into a blind obliviousness with social games, psychological tricks, personal preoccupations so far removed from the reality of his situation that they are forms of madness, but madness all the same. Engaging in madness, just blind obliviousness. And it's not the them, it's us, right? We do this. Let's identify, yeah, we do this, it's okay. Until we admit that, yeah, we do this too. Of course we do this. We can't turn around, because until we actually identify, yeah, these are the ways I deny death. We can't have the integrity, we can't really sit upright and say, okay. It's like AA, okay. My name is Nikki and I'm a death denier. Okay, until you just admit it, own it, right? Yeah. Ah, you can't quite face it that, yeah, I'm gonna die. It's okay. I haven't been denying it so far, living as if I'm going to live forever. Like, I'm not going to live forever. Of course not. But I'm living as if I do. Like, I just keep planning for tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and the next year and the year after that and 5 years from now and then 10 years from now. Right? And not to say that there's anything wrong with planning, as long as we also are, so that we hold both ends. Right? We plan, and we also have this sense of impermanence that there may not be a tomorrow. How do I want to live today if there was no tomorrow? And yet you're going to plan for tomorrow. So holding those two dichotomies, together instead of privileging one over the other. And that's another important message I want to give. We usually privilege one, just all the planning and planning. Ah, I'm not ready to die yet. I have a plan. 10 years, I'm going to be blah, blah, blah. Right? Plan. And yet hold, really hold the same level, the impermanence that, yeah, I could die tonight. I may not wake up. But every day might be my last day. So living with both of those intensities. So just a couple of words about terror management theory, just since I brought it up. So TMT proposes that there is a basic psychological conflict, that it results from us having a self-preservation instinct, because we're humans and we know we're going to die, and we're like, okay, I don't want to die. There's a sense of self-preservation, yes, we acknowledge that. And then at the same time, realizing that we're going to die, that it's inevitable, not only inevitable, but it's unpredictable to a large extent. And that brings a psychological conflict. And the theory suggests that that psychological conflict produces terror, a sense of terror. We know we're going to die. We don't want to die. We have a self-preservation instinct. And that terror, we, as humans, as societies, we try to manage that terror by the ways that you named, many, many ways that you named, by embracing cultural beliefs, symbolic systems, durable forms of value, legacy, religion, denial, just shopping, addiction, you name it, othering. Someone mentioned there's some studies about that. All of these ways. It's a theory. It's not fact, but it's an interesting theory to consider. Yeah. So, but there is another way. Of course there's another way. And somebody mentioned it here. Peace. Of course, of course. And we are here to because our hearts want that peace, want all the gifts that come from that peace for ourselves, for our loved ones, and for many, many circles out. So let me share one more thing before I move to sharing some of the gifts of this practice. In terms of there is another way, I want to contrast how the Westerners tend to deal with mortality and death. And an example from actually the tsunami in Thailand. So I want to read a few paragraphs for you. And this is from, this showed up in the Tricycle magazine in winter of 2014. And the article, the name of the article is The Sea of Sorrow. And it was written by Rona Kabatsnik, who's a psychologist and Buddhist practitioner who was in Thailand when the tsunami hit in 2004. So I'll read this. It's well worth so. And actually, I was recently in Thailand, and on the beaches, I was having memories of reading this and the tsunami. So just the sense of felt sense. So here we go. So Rana writes, there were shots of bikini-clad corpses on beaches and stunned survivors frantically searching among them for loved ones. So they had boards with images where people were searching. Video clips showed demolished homes and hotels, capsized fishing boats, crushed cars, and acres of debris. Seawater still gushed from broken storefronts, windows, and down streets and alleys. So basically on that day, 227,000 people died, 125,000 injured, 45,000 missing, and 1.69 million people were displaced when the tsunami hit. The Thai way of grieving, from what I could see, was composed, reflecting what is known as Jai Yen, a cool heart, Mourners appeared to see death as part of life, not as an injustice or a dreadful mistake, even when it was unexpected or swift. And Thailand is a very Buddhist country, as you know, as part of the culture of these values. She continues, expressing emotions wasn't an issue for Westerners who had Jai Ron, a hot heart. Many felt angry and betrayed by the tsunami and by the experts who didn't detect it in time to transmit warnings. They should have known how irresponsible, they declared. Parents bitterly blamed themselves for not being able to protect their children from death. I'm a bad parent. It's my fault, they confessed, as if they were personally responsible for the natural disaster. Do we recognize this? Yeah. The difference between the two perspectives demonstrates one of the Buddha's key teachings. Our minds are habituated to relate to suffering by resisting it through blame, bitterness, anger, resentment. That resistance is what the Buddha called the second arrow, which follows the first arrow, the direct experience of pain. So much additional suffering comes from believing that things shouldn't be this way, when in fact they are that way. Although tragedy and loss feel personal, they are not. Suffering and loss are built into the human condition. I spoke with one local woman in her late 20s who stood beside three stacked caskets containing her young son, daughter, and husband. Pentamada, Pentamachat, she whispered in response to my condolences. This is natural. This is nature. This is natural. This is nature. Very different way of being with loss. So how? How do we shift our perspective to have peace, to have acceptance of how things are? Which is different. Acceptance is different from resignation. Maybe I'll talk more about that later tonight or another time on the retreat. But the two are very different. Resignation is giving up, whereas acceptance is accepting that things are this right now and they cannot be changed. And there's a sense of integrity that things are like this right now and they cannot be changed. And resisting them brings more suffering. The Buddha says in the Dhammapada, whatever you frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of your mind. Many of you might be familiar with this beautiful, strong, very powerful quote, powerful teaching. Whatever you frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of your mind. So if we frequently ponder upon how scary death is, how terrible it is, how unjust it is, how it shouldn't happen, how poor me, poor others, like of course that becomes the inclination of our minds. That's who we become if we think it that way. We can shift that if we ponder that it is normal, it is natural. Everyone dies, of course. Everything that is born is going to die, of course. Part of being human, being animal, being born, being alive, everything that's alive dies, of course. When we ponder and think frequently in a different way, then the natural response of our heart, it changes. It changes. Of course it changes. It can't be any other way. That's the only way. So as a way of pondering upon what is skillful, what is helpful, what produces, what causes less suffering, more peace, I would like to share with you some of the benefits of Maranasati practice, mindfulness of mortality practice. Some of these you may already know, but some of these I will, maybe you'll resonate with. So the first, I would say, the order depends on who you are when you are in life, but there are various benefits of this practice. Some of the benefits have to do with how we live our life. Hence the title of this retreat. It's Befriending Mortality, Living an Awakened Life Through Mindfulness of Death. So it's living an awakened life, right? We want to put that front and center. It's how we live. We want to live an awakened life. So the benefits of mindfulness of mortalities have to do with how we live our life, how it transforms us to become kinder, more generous, more just awakened, how to wake up. And then there are some benefits at death, at the moment of death, how we die. So we are also, through this practice, we are preparing to die in a graceful way, not scared or out of our wits, but with peace, like curious about the mystery. And then there are two other dimensions of the benefits. So the benefits for our life, for death. And now the other dimensions is for other people's lives, other people's deaths. Actually, our practice heavily benefits our loved ones. So we can be of support to them when they die, and also support to them in their life so that we can have these conversations. So all of these different dimensions, I'll go through a few of them. So the very first one I would say is that for the way that we live, knowing that our time is short, really knowing that our time is short, and contemplating that every day, that this could be my last day. Time is short. It helps us with what's called the misalignment problem. And the misalignment problem is we have a set of values. We want to spend our time in a particular way. We want to show up in the world in particular ways. But we don't. We just don't. It's called the misalignment problem. Familiar? Anyone? Yeah. I'll give you a couple of studies. So here's a study that was done in 2004 by the Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. They surveyed a group of women and asked them how much satisfaction they derived from their daily activities, the daily activities that they chose. So it wasn't their work, it's like their free time. Because well, your free time, and tell us what you enjoy and how you're doing. So you would expect that people would do what they say they would enjoy doing, right? What they value doing, right? That sounds sane, right? Guess what? And this is us. It's not just them. There are a couple of studies. So both women and everyone included. So in the study, this group of women reported that they derived more satisfaction from prayer, worship, meditation than from watching television. And yet, the average responder spent more than five times as long watching television than engaging in any of those other activities. Five times, right? So they have these values. We have these values. Yes, we derive value. But how are we spending our time? Because, oh, yeah, I've got time. I can watch that rerun for the 10th time. Right? Because we don't realize it's this precious resource. Our time, it's limited. And there's another study also similarly that was done 2014 that It's actually even worse than that, that an average American adult spends four times as long watching television than socializing and communicating, which they said they like more, socializing with friends, etc. And then 20 times longer watching television than spiritual activities. So, of course, that didn't include surfing the web, but you can imagine that would be high up there. So the solution to this is not the stick to say, okay, I'm going to stop wasting time. Like, okay, New Year's resolution, I'm going to stop wasting time. Right? Yes, great, good luck. What really, really works is to bring the sense of scarcity of our time to the front of our face. My time is scarce. Do I really want to do this thing? Do I really want to mindlessly veg on this thing? I mean, sometimes if you're really, really exhausted and tired, it's okay to give your mind a rest, your body. And I'm saying to be on all the time, not saying that. But to be more judicious about the precious resource that our time is. Are we spending it according to our values? What is really, really meaningful for us, knowing that it's limited. So bringing that scarcity, the fact that the time is limited, into our consciousness through Maranasati, mindfulness of death, these daily practices, which we're going to start sharing with you one by one, that you can practice every day. Practice every day. Yeah, my time is short. This could be my last breath. This could be my last day. Oh, yeah. Every morning when you wake up, yeah, this could be my last day. Thank you. What a pleasure and honor to be alive. This could be it. I'll share something from Sam Harris. I like this quote from him. So he says, most of us do our best to not think about death. But there's always part of our minds that knows this can't go on forever. Part of us always knows that we're just a doctor's visit away or a phone call away from being starkly reminded of the fact of our own mortality or of those closest to us. The one thing people tend to realize at moments like this is that we have wasted a lot of time. It's not just that we spent too much time working or compulsively checking email. It's that we cared about the wrong things. We regret that we cared. We regret what we cared about. Our attention was bound up in petty concerns year after year. When life was normal, and guess what, people? Life is normal right now. As abnormal it might be, if you're alive, if you're on retreat, life is still normal. Anyway, I'll continue. Our attention was bound up in petty concerns year after year when life was normal. This is a paradox, of course, because we all know this epiphany is coming. Don't you know this is coming? You know this, and yet if you're like most people, you'll spend most of your time in life tacitly presuming you live forever, like watching a bad movie for the fourth time, or bickering with your spouse. These things only make sense in light of eternity. How many things do we do that only make sense in light of eternity? If we lived forever, but we don't. We just don't. None of us does. I'm delighted to be accompanied by these two skeletons. I wanted to actually have one sit next to me as a reminder. Oh, but then again, I am a skeleton, actually. I'm a skeleton sitting here. It's just that for now there is some flesh and some skin on the skeleton sitting on the seat. But this is a skeleton. There are three skeletons in front of you. This one has life for a limited time. And guess what? So does the one that's sitting in your seat. I'm looking at skeletons. This room. Every single one of us. Powerful. So aligning with our values, living true to our values, which for different people could be different things, but for many people include being more loving, being more generous, being more kind, being more wise, waking up in this life. How are we spending our time? The Buddha says, the nights and days are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? A practitioner should reflect upon. The nights and days are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? Jack Kornfield, friend and mentor, in his one of his books, in A Path with Heart, says, in the end, actually, where is the full quote? I don't have the full quote here, but basically that if you're sitting with people at their end of life, the questions they ask aren't, how much is in my bank account? How many books did I write? Or, you know, what a big empire I created. At the end, just three things matter. How well have we lived? Have I lived? How well have I loved? How well have I learned to let go? How well have we lived, loved, and learned to let go? So living according to our values, learning while we're alive, kindness, compassion, and mindfulness of mortality, mindfulness of our death, actually, it brings more compassion and kindness. I wonder if you felt that today as you engaged in your contemplations with one another. As you were feeling into the common humanity of the suffering, of death, of loss, was there more compassion for everyone? Was there? Actually, show of hands, how many people felt more compassion? Yeah, yes. So mindfulness of death brings a sense of compassion both for yourself and for others. So if one of your values is to live with more kindness, more compassion in the world for yourself and others, this practice is connected, mindfulness of death is connected to the practice of metta, loving kindness, to the practice of karuna, compassion practice, self-compassion and compassion for others. It can be the seed, the root of that. They're connected. Also, the practice of forgiveness. In the Dhammapada, see if I can find, going a little out of order in my talk, just because that's what's arising. In the Dhammapada, and many of you might be familiar with the first part of this, but the second part is actually quite profound. So the first part, the Dhammapada is famous lines that hatred never ends through hatred. By love alone does it cease. This is an ancient and eternal law. So many of you might have heard that. But the second, the continuation of that verse is, many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. That's powerful. When you really realize you're mortal, you're really dying, and other people are too, but all of us die, quarrels end. A sense of forgiveness that arises naturally, maybe not immediately, so don't force yourself, like, okay, I'm going to do this practice, I'm going to forgive right away. It's like, be gentle, but there's an insight that can arise. insight into forgiveness and quarrels ending with that sense of mortality, this tenderness of letting go. It's the ultimate letting go. When we learn to let go of ourselves, of our lives, of ourselves, letting go of grudges, letting go of, they did this, they said that, it's like, ugh, they die too, right? It's so impermanent. Can I forgive? They are mortal, just like I am. I am mortal. There's compassion for that mortality. All of us. Being born naked, dying naked, going into the earth. So also considering that death gives life meaning. So this is a thesis I want to offer for your consideration. You know, we often perhaps think, and there are all these stories of elixirs of immortality, right? So let's question our assumptions about immortality. There's this Buddhist story of mortals, the story of immortals that are lying in a ditch. That are lying in a ditch, they're covered by mud. Think for a moment. They're immortals. They're lying in a ditch. They're not moving. They're covered by mud. They're not doing anything. They're not lifting a finger. Why? Because they have time. You see that, right? There's time. There's immortality. I'll move. I'll cover, you know, I'll clean up another time. I can lie in the ditch. Right? Interesting perspective. So that's a Buddhist story about, don't think about immortality being such an awesome thing. There was another, actually a few years ago, there's this opera by the Czech composer, Janáček, and it's called the Makropoulos Case. And it's really about the tedium of immortality, which I hadn't considered, and it's really well done. You know, art is amazing. We will engage in some poetry and some art later in this retreat, but art can be an amazing way to explore these possibilities. So I'll share this with you. So in this story, there was a woman who looks 30 years old, but in a body of a 30-year-old, but she's actually 330 years old. So when she was younger, there was an elixir. She got the elixir of youth, drank it. Long story, complicated story. But now she's lived 330 years, and the elixir of immortality is starting to wane. So she shows up. She goes through all kinds of machinations to try to get the recipe back, recipe that she used 300 years ago. So at the end of the opera, she gets the recipe. She's going to make it. And then she realizes, you know what? She's tired of living. She's lived. It's the samsara. It's really the samsara of coming and going. And she's seen it all. And she's been, you know, she's birthed so many children over so many continents. And she's had so many loves and so many losses. It's just like come and gone and come and gone. And it's just like, you know, this is not as what it's piped up to be, this immortality thing. And this is the verses, or the poetry that she sings, translated, of course. It's a great mistake to live so long. Oh, and she's telling the mortals there. Oh, if you could only know how easy life is for you. You are so close to life. You see in life some meaning. Life has some value. Fools, how happy you all are. And it's due to the paltry chance that you will all die soon. Wow. You believe in mankind, love, virtue, progress. There's nothing more than you can want. But in me, life has come to a standstill. I cannot go on. How dreadful this loneliness. In the end, it's the same. Singing in silence. There's no joy in goodness, no joy in evil. Joyless in the earth, joyless in the sky. When you know that, then your soul dies within you. So life having meaning because of death, because it's short, impermanent. Interesting to consider. I offer that for your consideration. Opened my eyes years ago. Like, oh, wow. Sweet. This life is sweet because it's short, because there's limited supply of it, limited moments. Wow. So, in terms of gifts of this practice, the way we live according to our values, with awakening in life, learning to let go, learning to let go in life, the practice of letting go, which we'll cover more later in the retreat, the practice of letting go, because there's an ultimate letting go at the time of death, but during life, we learn how to let go, let go, let go. And let go is synonymous to non-attachment, non-clinging, right? And it's synonymous with freedom of the heart. The heart that doesn't cling, attaches, holds with ease, holds everything, holds the comings and goings with an open heart. Freedom, a sense of freedom, being in the world, being engaged, and yet having a sense of ease, openness of heart. And freedom is a translation of Nibbana. Awakening. You see that? So letting go, how I got from letting go to awakening, they're related. The heart is open. Yes, yes, doesn't resist. Still, there's a lot of aspiration, a lot of aspiration for goodness, but there's not the resistance and the fear and the hatred and the greed. It's just the sense of opening. So, learning to let go, learning non-clinging through the practice of Marnasati in daily life. And now I want to talk about a few gifts for our death. So, as I mentioned earlier, we practice to make peace with death so that when it happens, we're not scared, we're open. Maybe curious even, if we are lucky enough to be conscious, who knows what's going to happen. We don't know when and how it's going to happen, but if we are lucky enough to be conscious to enjoy the ride, who knows? Nobody has really come back, really. I mean, there's some near-death experiences and all that we'll talk about, but to have a sense of who knows? Who knows? To not be afraid, to not be afraid, to be conscious, to be curious about this human experience. What is it like to die? What is it? I'm curious. I'm certainly curious. I have loved ones who've died. They've all done it successfully. So I'm curious, what is it like? What is it like, this experience that we're all going to have? I don't want to be scared. Well, I'm not scared. I've done this practice for so long. I'll talk more about my experience later. And also, we can serve others. We can serve others, our loved ones. When we are not afraid of our death, we can have conversations with our loved ones, whether they are the next generation, our children or grandchildren. It's the biggest teaching. It's the biggest gift we can give them. To say, okay, I want to talk about this. It's okay. It's the biggest gift that they see us not being afraid. Similarly, the biggest gift we can give to, if we are dying, to hold it for them, and if the younger or we're the person who's holding space for the person who is dying, to hold space for them, because we're not afraid, we can let them have their own experience. So it's a gift that we can give either way. I'll share this with you. My mom passed away, and we were very close. She passed away 4 years ago, and she didn't have fear of death. She had had a near-death experience, which I'll talk about later, and many people who have near-death experiences, they lose fear of death. So she had lost her fear of death. So she was present, she was shining, she was holding my hand. And for me, having done this practice for as long as I have, I was not uncomfortable with her dying. It was time. I still miss her, but given what was happening with her body and health and age, it was natural. So for me to allow her to have her own experiences of trying to fix it, and it's like, no, like, letting her have her experience. So holding each other, the gift that we can give each other, to hold each other in that way. And of course, in my case also, I was holding the space for the whole family, because I was modeling, it's okay, it's all right, we've done our best, and now this is, let her die in peace, not hooked up to all kinds of machines, die at peace at home. Gracious, graceful exit. So such a gift this practice is, that you engage in for everyone, for your loved ones, older, younger, same generation, just all around. And also this practice of letting go, there are some teachings about letting go at the moment of death, taught to Anathapindika, which we'll talk about. Again, I'm planting a lot of seeds for things we're going to talk later in the retreat. And the teachings about letting go at the time of death. So liberation at the time of death. And that also, if the mind does not wake up through life, there is an opportunity at the moment of death to let go. So that's beautiful too, and we can train for that. We can practice that complete letting go. So we're not scared, like, okay, yeah, let go. The time has come, yeah, offering up. A couple of last things I'll mention for closing, and one is the practices we will mention, that basically mindfulness of our own mortality, the precious of the scarcity, preciousness of our time, can bring a sense of aliveness. Really, many of you, having practiced mindfulness, you know that there can be a sense of freshness sometimes can arise, like colors can feel brighter, and there's this sense of aliveness, like in the moment you're really alive with all your senses. So practice of marnasati can take that and put that on steroids. It's the sense of real aliveness. Wow, this could be my last moment. This could be my last breath. This could be it. We'll talk about that later, about those instructions. We'll lead you through them. But that practice especially can be really enlivening. So the last thing I want to say is one gift of this practice, many gifts, one gift of this practice that we're engaging together. You're courageous, you're bold enough to be here and avail yourself of these teachings is waking up to living our life as a sacred offering. Can we live our life as a sacred offering? As a sacred offering, 360 degrees. And the 360 includes ourselves. Can we live our life as a sacred offering to this being who is me? I know the logic feels a little twisted. Let me repeat that. This sense that, wow, this is a precious life. Can it be lived as an offering, both to others, to be of service, to live this world a better place as much as possible, for their benefit, and also leave this being who is me, the karmic imprint, if you believe in karma or not, it's just the imprints that this being who is me is leaving in the world. We can, you know, you can think about it in a secular way. To live it as a sacred offering in that way. So that life is not this expectation, the sense of entitlement that, oh, I was given only these many years, I wanted more. Oh, it's amazing that I came to be at all. Out of all the books that could have been written, all the sperms and eggs, and this is the being who came to be. Wow, I'm alive. How did this happen? I don't know. Incredible. We don't even know what consciousness is, and we want more of it. So appreciating, this is amazing. This is so incredible that anything exists at all for any length of time. So really getting that, we want to fall on our knees and kiss the earth that I am conscious. There is this me who I don't understand who this person even is. This miracle of being is existing for any length of time. And the miracles of life of people I've loved have existed for any length of time. Instead of the sense of expectation or entitlement. Like, yeah, more. Of course, like just the fact that they even lived. They even came into my life. Thank you. Thank you, universe. Wow, I'm alive. I'm conscious. I'm not an earthworm. I'm a human. That is the perspective that we can have through this practice. And that's what I wish for all of you and more through this practice. Let's just sit together and let the words settle. May through this practice, we all wake up to our amazing, amazing gift of humanity, being alive. May we wake up fully. May our practice be of service to freedom, to the waking up of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for your kind attention. We have a walking period now. do recommend, if you have energy, to walk now. Don't go to bed just yet. It's nice after a Dharma talk to walk, to just let the reflections settle. See what is helpful, what needs to continue to reverberate. And there is a sit at 9 p.m. If you have energy, please come back to the hall. There will be a little reflection to put you to bed. Okay, thank you.